Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, the importance of bone health and how to mind yours, the reality of life as a family carer, and performance coach Charlie Norton-Sherwood on the lessons he's learned from working with Premiership footballers. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, I had a busy one where I said yes way too many times. I do think it's tricky though when the invites and the work opportunities that you don't want to miss out come thick and fast. I had commitments with my daughter, a brilliant work event, hosting a panel, ironically, about juggling family and working life, a night out with my mom, a networking event in the most beautiful surrounds. I mean, you can see why it's hard to say no, but I do have to balance those yeses with some no's eventually, have some slower days at home, often catching up on household stuff, staying in early nights, and sometimes it's reaching for things that fill me up, like time with friends, something wellnessy like a sound bath or a sea swim and a sauna. What goes up must come down. And my daughter graduated from primary school this week, so that's a big milestone and the end of a parenting era. I do remember sobbing a couple of years ago at my son's graduation, mainly because we were also moving house at that time. And I was literally saying goodbye to a community and the kids and the parents that I had started primary school with. Whereas this time, I know I'll see these people around a lot more. So there was a wobble, but not the same gush this time around. I'm happy for her to move on to this next phase, and I try to enjoy them all rather than constantly looking back. You can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, Charlie Norton-Sherwood is a performance coach, having studied sports science at UCD, an internship at Leicester City led to a job there, and then on to Arsenal, where he was their strength and conditioning coach. But he felt a pull to something else, helping people figure out what they want from life, and he joins me in studio now. Charlie, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, Claire.
The stuff of dreams to be in Premiership football, especially a student of sports science. What did you learn from that time?
I guess so much. And it really was my dream for quite a while. As soon as I entered sports science, trying to be a strength and conditioning coach within a Premier League academy was the stuff of dreams for me. But I think over time, when I was in that situation, you just slowly fall out of love with the environment that you're in when you start those questions within.
And it's elite level, you know, and obviously it's very cool. So many people follow these huge, massive teams. So to see behind the Iron Curtain, I'm sure, is really exciting. But we also hear other things from elite sport. What happens at retirement? You live and die by the scorecard. You know, it can be tough to have that amount of pressure. Is that something you were also watching and absorbing?
There's definitely an element of that pressure, especially so I would have been within the academy when I worked in Premier League football. And you have all of the pressure upon those individuals around trying to perform to the top level, but they're negotiating contracts, they're trying to make it at the professional level. And it just adds up with all this weight upon them at times.
Yeah, and with the academy, I suppose some people don't make it onto the team. So were you seeing dreams begin and end?
Almost. That was probably the hardest part of the job when there was at certain age groups where players would get released or retained. And when some of those individuals who you've known throughout the years that you've gotten close to, when they were released, that's pretty hard upon them, seeing, and hard upon yourself as well, seeing them go through that.
And I suppose when you're a footballer, if you show a talent at a young age, you go to an academy, you get into a Premiership team, you don't really think beyond that. But you were starting to notice there were players who were wondering, what's next? What else is out there? Who am I without football? Do you think that was the start of leading to what it is that you do now?
I think we all almost go through those questions within around our work, our career, our identity, and what we do can come to define all of who we are. And we wrap ourselves so closely with what that is. I could see it within players where football became their life, but also within myself and the staff around me where strength and conditioning was my life. Strength and conditioning within football was my life. And slowly over time, you start to question, well, is this the life that I want for myself? Do I want to devote all of myself to this? What about everything else that I have going on? What about all those other buckets that makes up our life in terms of our family, our friendships, those people that we love? And if we start devoting so much of ourselves towards our career, and then years down the line when we turn around and need those people the most, well, they might not be there because for so long they've just got the scraps of our attention because all we've been focused on is work.
And that's so interesting. And we get so caught up in what we should be doing or how we should be feeling or what's important. And I suppose you were ticking so many boxes. You had a really cool job, a job you were good at, a job you enjoyed. I'm sure you were earning good money. You're living in London. That's got another level of cool attached to it. You met your wife. So you're living a good life. But there's a whisper sometimes that we start to get that gets louder, and it can be difficult to listen to when you see that list of accolades. And, it all makes sense on paper. But if it's not making sense within, you have to start listening. But it's challenging, isn't it?
It definitely is. And I know within your book, you talk around that trap of shoulds that we can get lost in. And sometimes how when we don't question ourselves and start to turn inner and ask these questions, we can kind of get caught on this roller coaster, this hamster wheel of life where we go from school to college or apprenticeships. And sooner all these years go by and we start asking ourselves, well, was this the life that I ever really wanted? We start climbing that ladder without actually asking ourselves, well, was that ladder up on the right wall to begin with?
I love the work of Mo Gaudat. He's a brilliant author, and he talks about the analogy of a video game. And sometimes we've just, got enough from that level. And it doesn't matter how cool that level is. Sometimes we need a different level. We need to level up. We've learned all we're going to learn there. Do you think that was adding a little bit to you? You had done all you were going to perhaps do in that role. You could have stayed forever, but it was time for something else.
I think within myself, I actually hadn't done everything that I could within that role. For so long, I had written down on a piece of paper, try to become a strength and conditioning coach within a first team in the Premier League. That was that big goal. But seeing the sacrifices that people would have to make within those positions, that's not what I was willing to make. I didn't really want to leave a trail of broken relationships behind me, trying to get into a position where I thought I really wanted that. And I love what you're saying about Mo Gaudat. And there's that idea from Rick Rubin where he says around passion, and don't confuse being good at something with just being a passionate person. Because when you are a passionate person, well, when you devote yourself to anything, you could probably become pretty good at that. So try and use your passion to follow the things that really light you up. And when you find that avenue, well, think of the amazing work you could do there.
So you moved back to Ireland and you've set up now as a performance coach. And this is what you do. You help people figure out, what is the next step? Is this the right ladder you have to be on? And what do you find with people? Are they overwhelmed? I hear a lot from people and from myself, I don't know what I want. Do you think we do and we're just afraid to say it?
I think sometimes we can get confused because we feel like we need to have that succinct thing, that ladder laid out in front of us. But I don't know if we always need that exact roadmap for moving forward. We just need to know that next step that we need to take. In 1933, Carl Jung gets this letter from a person and she's asking him advice upon how to live. And he responds with, but if you do with conviction the next and most necessary thing, you're always doing something meaningful and intended by faith. And I think sometimes we just need to bring ourselves back to that principle when we feel most lost and uncertain of what is the next most necessary thing that I need to do?
Yeah. And how do I want to feel? Because we always look at what do I need to do and think about our career. And obviously we have bills to pay and responsibilities. And of course, I get all of that. I often think manifesting is quite a privilege term to be able to use. But we all deserve to feel content in our life. And let that be the focus. How do I want to feel? Because that's something I'm really taking from what you're saying. You wanted to have time for the people in your life. So you needed a job that would have a little bit more flexibility. And that was your first step to realizing that.
Yeah, definitely. And what you're saying there around following those signs that your life is alluding towards of, well, what are those things and those moments that give you joy and how much are you having of them within your week? And equally noting, well, where am I feeling really drained? Where am I feeling really drained and lethargic and energy zapped almost? And using those as guideposts to guide you towards those answers that you're seeking.
How do you feel in your life now?
I would say my relationships since moving home, it's been one of the best things for me and my wife. For being around family as well, the simple pleasure of just like dropping around to the house and seeing my mom, my stepdad, my brother and sister. It's that part of life that we didn't have in London. yet there's still uncertainty. You're still trying to navigate yourself in this career. So I've taken that step into something a little bit different. So there's still those tumultuous waters ahead, but just trying to be patient, and we take it week by week where we can.
I love it. Where can people find out more to work with you?
Yeah, if you just Google my name, Charlie Norton Sherwood, my website should come up.
Charlie, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, we hear a lot more these days about the importance of bone health, particularly as we age, and women are at a higher risk of osteopenia and osteoporosis. Annette Cashel is a bone health coach prescribing movement as one of our most powerful tools, and she joins me in studio now. Annette, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Claire. Thanks for having me.
And we should say from the outset, obviously, when we say prescribing movement, that's alongside medical professionals and medication, if that is what is needed. But tell us a little bit about you and how you came to be a bone health coach.
I guess it's a personal story. So my background is I worked in IT for 10 years, and then I became a Pilates teacher because of back problems that I had. I thought I had my life sorted. I was a Pilates teacher. I'd never have another health issue in my life. So when I was diagnosed with osteopenia, which is a form of bone loss, I was pretty shocked because I thought I was doing everything right.
And what age were you when that diagnosis came?
I was 47.
Okay.
47, yeah. But I thought I was doing everything right. I was, you know, a fitness instructor. I had a good diet, all these things. So it forced me to look into a little bit deeper into maybe what I was doing wrong and what had been, my, I guess, the blind spots I had in my practice.
Okay. And what are the reasons? What can lead to bone loss?
Well, there are lots of risk factors. You could have history of anorexia or dieting. You could be on certain medications that are steroid-based or thyroid medicine or maybe cancer treatments. So there's lots of different risk factors going on, but I had none of those. So it forced me to look at the bigger picture. And I realized that even though I was exercising, I wasn't exercising smart, the way that really had an impact on my bones.
And what is the setup of our bones and our bone health?
Okay. So I guess if I define what osteoporosis is, to begin with, osteoporosis is a disease that makes your bones weak and brittle and prone to fracture. It doesn't mean they will fracture, but you're more likely to break a bone if you fall, for example. And we tend to focus on the bone density number, the number you get in your DEXA scan, your T-score, but it also is a change in the architecture of your bone. So two people could have the same DEXA score but have a very different fracture risk depending on the risk factors in their life. For example, you might have minus two in your hip and another person might have minus two in their hip, but that other person maybe has terrible balance, has a terrible diet, has smoked all their lives, is an alcoholic. Their risk of breaking a bone is way higher than yours if you have great balance, good diet, moving, never smoked, you know? So it's not as clear cut as focusing on that one number from your DEXA scan.
And can you
more nuanced than that.
Can you explain to people who might not know what a DEXA scan is?
Yes, absolutely. So DEXA scan is an X-ray scan that looks at the quantity of your bone. It takes a picture of your bone and it gives you a number. And the number is then what we focus on because that's the only data that we have. It doesn't tell us about the quality of the bone. So you get the quality of the bone information from another scan called REMS, R-E-M-S, which is not in Ireland as far as I know. But there is a ways to get REM scans in Ireland, but there's nothing nationwide available. The REM scan is a 3D picture and the DEXA is a 2D. So you can imagine that 3D picture will be much better for your bones than 2D. But at the moment, the gold standard is DEXA. So when you do a DEXA scan, which is painless and takes a few minutes, you get a number. And we want to improve that number if you are in the osteoporosis or osteopenia range.
And a DEXA scan isn't necessarily available to everyone. It gives us very valuable information about our lean muscle mass and our bone health, but people only really get access to it later in life. And one of your key messages is we need to start thinking about our bone health a lot earlier.
That would be my ideal world scenario, absolutely. So at the moment, it's from the age of 65 that you get a DEXA scan in Ireland, unless you have a risk factor like celiac disease or maybe you've had breast cancer. But my wish would be women get DEXA scans at an earlier age because we tend to think osteoporosis is a little old lady disease. That's when the fractures occur, but it's the bone loss really occurs in our mid-30s. That's when things start to change. So if we had a scan at around 40, it would be give us a benchmark to know where we are, and it also might give us a little incentive to work a little bit harder on our bone health at that age when you have the biggest runway, you know, you have the biggest chance to make a difference in your mid-40s.
Why are women more susceptible to bone health loss?
It's to do with estrogen. So when we lose estrogen after menopause, on average, you can lose up to 20% of your bone loss in those 7 years post-menopause. So it's a big decline. We build our bones in our childhood. So the more active your children are, fantastic. You build up to 90% of your bone health up to the age of 18 and 20. That's why active childhoods are so important. Then you build a little bit more until around your 30s. And then from the mid-30s on, you start to lose more bone than build. So the seesaw has changed and you're now on the downward curve. So you have to work a little bit harder to keep giving the signal to your skeleton to create that bone.
And even as you're saying it, I'm thinking of that milk ad that just got into our hearts and souls back when we used to have to sit through the ad break, and about the importance of calcium and milk for your bones. But there's more to it than that, isn't there?
Absolutely. Yeah. My focus is on movement, and that's really half the picture. The other picture is nutrition. It's very important, obviously. And then you have things like supplementation if you can't drink milk, for example. So calcium is an important part, absolutely, for building bone. But supplementation or diet on its own is not enough. Movement on its own is not enough. You do need the two to marry together to get the full picture.
And you said you were a Pilates teacher. You'd stepped away from the 9 to 5. You know, I'm sure you were more active.
Yeah.
So where were you going wrong, in inverted commas?
Well, I was what they call an active couch potato. I don't know if you know that term.
No.
So a couch potato is somebody who never exercises and never moves. And an active couch potato is somebody who maybe goes to the gym every day, maybe exercises very intensely, but outside that exercise time, doesn't move much more than the couch potato. And that's kind of what I fell into. I was exercising maybe 1 or 2 hours a day, but outside of that official exercise time, I wasn't using the stairs, I wasn't parking further away from the shops, I was avoiding walking if I could, I wasn't carrying my shopping bags, and I was using a trolley. I was sitting for hours at a time, outside my exercise time. I was at a desk, really, you know, promoting my courses. So I was sitting as much as a couch potato, other than that 1 or 2 hours a day.
That's so interesting, because so many of us go to the class and go, right, well, that's my exercise box ticked.
That's exactly it.
So is it those little micro moments that you spoke about, taking the stairs over the lift, not using a trolley, little micro moments? How do you live differently now?
Oh, there's no comparison to my life. I think a really good analogy is a food analogy. And for some reason, we really get the food analogy. Like if you had a friend who ate junk food all day but had a salad every night, you would say, listen, that salad is not going to undo the junk food that you had all day. Like the salad is good, but look at what you're doing the rest of the day. And exercise and movement is the same. If you think of going to the gym as the salad, it's very good for you, but it doesn't undo the sitting all day junk food. That's happened before. So I think that food analogy is really good. So when I got that light bulb moment went off, I just sat way less. So that was the number one thing. I looked at the amount of hours I was sitting. It was phenomenal. It really shocked me. So even though I have a desk job, as you part of the day, you can still break it up. So you don't have to sit 4 hours straight, you know, standing up every half an hour really makes a difference. All the studies have proven it. Even standing for a couple of minutes every hour can reduce your risk of lots of different diseases. So that was a big thing. Not sitting on a chair. I try to sit on the floor as much as I can. I know that's not available for everybody, but I watch TV sitting on the floor and a yoga bolster. I don't sit on a sofa anymore. I've changed my shoes because my shoes changed my posture.
How did you change your shoes?
So I looked at minimal shoes. So minimal shoes are shoes that have no heel, basically. So even when we think of a regular shoe nowadays, they have about a 2-inch heel. If you looked at runners lately, they're like 3-inch heels. So you might think you're wearing a sneaker or a runner that's no heel. But if you look at it closely, it actually has quite a high heel. And any heel that changes your body, knocks it out of alignment. And that's really important if you have osteoporosis, because you want to nail your posture as much as possible.
I'll have to look under the desk at this shoe. Oh, you're in a nice sandal.
Yeah, exactly. They used to be very strange looking minimal shoes, but I have to say they have really improved. So don't be scared when you hear the term no heel. You can find resources on my website about that. But other people have done amazing work in that area.
Yeah, and just if you're at home, maybe being barefoot. And just having that consciousness in your mind of bringing in these little moments. And the good news is our bones are renewing themselves. So it's never really too late to start.
Absolutely. And that's my one message of hope, is that it's never too late to start. Obviously, the earlier you start, the better. But your bones are constantly remodeling themselves, just like your skin. Like, we know the way our skin cells are remodeling all the time. Your bones are the same. So roughly every 10 years, you have a brand new skeleton. So the great news is that anything you do to input positively into your skeleton will improve, not just the bone density, but the bone quality as well. I guess the other message I want to get across is if you have a scary T-score result from your DEXA scan, we are focusing on fracture risk, not just the number you get in your DEXA scan. Let's really work on your fracture risk, and you can reduce that very easily by working on your balance.
And people might be listening and think, well, I want to know where I'm at. I want to know my numbers. I want to get this DEXA scan. Is there any way for them to even get that privately? What should they do?
Absolutely. I would highly recommend getting a DEXA scan as a benchmark, whether you have a history of osteoporosis in your family or not. I didn't have that history in my family. I still got it. I wasn't a smoker. I wasn't a dieter. I didn't even drink till I was 25. Like, you don't know really, you know, if you might have a risk factor. I sat an awful lot. I think that was a big risk factor in my particular life. But yes, you can get it privately. I think it costs about 100, 150 euros, something like that. You can also talk to your doctor and say, I do have these risk factors, which they may not be aware that you have this concern. So definitely reach out to your GP and see if you can do it publicly. And if not, you do have the private route available to you.
Well, I think your message is powerful and yet simple. Small changes can really make a big difference. You have an excellent amount of information on your website and a range of different courses for people to do. You can find Annette on Instagram. She's at Annette Cashel, and there's a link tree there where you'll find everything that she does. Annette, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Claire.
I'm definitely going to stand up now to walk you out and say goodbye during this ad break. Thank you so much.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, Marina Giblin is a senior portfolio manager at a financial firm and mother to her much-loved daughter, Elsie, who was born with additional needs. We often hear of the struggles for support and long waiting lists, inadequacies in our education system, societal and policy support. So what is the reality in the home when you're parenting and caring in the midst of all of this? Well, I'm delighted to say that Marina joins me in studio now. Marina, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Claire. Nice to be here.
We met at an event. We were on a panel together and we started chatting. And when you told me about Elsie in your life, I really thought this was something I wanted to cover on the show. Because as I say, it's something we don't hear enough about. The carers, who are these people and what kind of impact is it having on your life? So I'm so grateful for you to come and share something that I know is very personal to you. I find it difficult to talk about my own kids as they get older. So I really appreciate you coming in.
No, thank you. Thank you. And it's a pleasure to be able to talk about it, to be fair. But I suppose I'd correct you on one thing.
Go on.
I don't see myself as Elsie's carer. I'm her mother. And most people in my position are mothers. And so you have a baby and you expect everything may be going all right. And then next thing you know, you have this baby that's special in different ways. And you don't plan for that at all. But as a mother, you know, you do what every other mother does. And so you try to navigate the world for your daughter or your son in the best way you can. But when you have a child like Elsie, and I like to call her exceptional because she's exceptional, she's different in some ways, you shouldn't have to take on the world to find her place in the world. And that to me has been eye-opening. I might have been naive because Elsie's condition has no name. So I thought, oh, this is great. Nobody can put a label on her. But then the world we live in, everyone wants a label. So you fight that first and then you take it from there.
And I really appreciate the correction. I'm always on for correction and learning. And it is an important distinction. And I want to ask you about terminology, because even when I was writing that introduction, I wondered how best to describe Elsie. And I said additional needs. We hear special needs. How do you feel about the term disability? Because we talk a lot about disability rights, and I have an issue now with disability. I think it's already starting on a negative about that person.
Well, I suppose if you take it right back to Ireland's historical past and the treatment of people that were vulnerable, we have a very sordid past. Like, basically, people were institutionalised, they were segregated. Most of the help or support that was given was charity-based. They were viewed as people to be pitied. They were viewed, you know, that they were separate from society. And a lot of that legacy is still there. So that's where the terminology comes. Like, Elsie's my daughter. That's it. Simple. And she sees that as herself. She's Elsie, and she doesn't see herself as any different than any other daughter. and she navigates life as best she can. She has a huge acceptance of her abilities that she needs help with and support with. And she knows she needs help and support. And that's not a surprise. But then she looks at me and she'll say, oh, well, you have this. And she looks at somebody else and she'll say, you have this. And if you look around you, everybody has something that differentiates them and they're different. But society, and somebody very wise said to me once, society is a little bit about crowd control. And if your child doesn't fit into a crowd, then that's where the situation starts. And, you know, we always talk about diversity and inclusion, and there's a lot of work done around, you know, all the people that are different. And my daughter is a little bit different. And that should be celebrated because differences add flavour. And why should it be so difficult to find her place in society to be included? And that's the way I view it. So the terminology kind of is people's discomfort with difference rather than correct or incorrect. And I've had people say different things to me, or I've been out with her and some old lady will come up and bless her and say, oh, I hope she gets better soon. And I just let it go because, like, Elsie doesn't need to get better. She is who she is. And if we could accept people for who they are, then the world would be a lot of an easier place to navigate.
And can you take me back to when Elsie was born? Because I imagine there was a lot of labelling and terminology that you had to get your head around with your new little baby in your arms.
Well, she was born in 2004, and my first child, my only child, and I didn't know. I was like, she was 9 pounds 7, big baby, and I had no idea that there may be, you know, something that might differentiate Elsie. And they said to me, she was an emergency C-section, and they said to me, oh, she's a bit floppy. And I thought, okay, well, aren't all babies floppy? Because, you know, I didn't know that they weren't floppy. And then she had some breathing difficulties and they took her to the NICU. And then I was kind of in the hospital there with no baby for a week. And it was the depth of winter, it was November. And then they did some tests and they came back with this very rare condition. There's only 1 in 40,000 people are born with it. And they didn't really know much. And they didn't know what her life would entail. They didn't know anything, really. And while I was in the hospital, I met another lady who'd had a baby who was in NICU. And we would meet for coffee every day. And her baby was right beside Elsie. And we made a lifelong friendship from that week we spent together in the coom. And it really helped me navigate the early years because we both had babies. We both didn't know where their lives would turn. But we had the support of each other. And you find when you have a new baby that everybody's like, oh, they're so cute. Oh, they're beautiful. So I really didn't tell anybody that there was, you know, reason to be concerned about Elsie's future or how she would develop or anything for the first few months. And it was really important for me to have those first few months where people would just look into the pram and think, oh, isn't she just a beautiful baby? And I then eventually, you know, Elsie didn't meet her milestones, her developmental milestones physically. So she didn't sit up when she should. So then at that point, after the first 3 months where I got used to the fact that my beautiful baby was a little bit different, I then started basically finding her all the help I could to help her meet her milestones. And that helped me then hugely because I felt that I was doing my best for her. So we started with, I think it was a Ukrainian lady used to come around and plop her up on the kitchen table and give her a full body massage when she was about 3 months old because she was hypotonia. She had hypotonia, which is low muscle tone.
And how much support was there? Because you mentioned when we first started talking about having to fight a lot of the time. And parenting is hard. It's a lot. And trying to, you know, juggle a working life and family life is difficult enough without trying to take on the lack of policy and support and the education system. That's hard and it's sad. Again, we come back to terminology and language being powerful. When it feels like a fight and a struggle, when did that first become apparent?
Well, I suppose in the early years, to stay working was very important financially because that gives you choices. And it also helps you maintain who you are as a person. So you have a life outside being a mother to an exceptional child. So to juggle that and to, you know, to be able to do that and stay working to give you the financial choices that you need is difficult, because with a baby that has additional needs, you know, whether it be feeding or developmental delay, you can't just put them into a creche because they won't survive, because nobody's going to spend 3 hours giving them a bottle. So that was never an option for early childcare. So then, you know, you have to try and source support. So I always, from the very beginning, felt that we needed support. And, you know, financially, because I was working, I was able to pay for that support. But what I'd really like to see is, you know, people who need those additional needs from the early stages be identified and a social worker assigned at birth. And then, you know, your benefits that you're entitled to made clear to you, not to have to go searching around for them. And then a personalised budget that you can hire additional support and help into the home to help you and give you the opportunity then to continue to work. And there's debate around carer's allowance being means tested. There's a lot of debate, but very little action, if I'm honest. And there's been a lot of legislation, particularly around, you know, I mean, the Epson Act hasn't still been ratified, which was introduced the year Elsie was born, and she's 21 going on 22. You know, the Assisted Decision-Making Act was brought forward in 2015, and it's only now coming into, you know, fruition. There's no adult safeguarding legislation. So there's a lot of talk, and there's a review of the Disability Act from 2005, and they want input. I mean, to be fair, what input do you need? The results are there to see. So it's, you know, you can talk all you want, but unless you take action and look for solutions, what's the point in talking?
What difference would that have made to Elsie's life if they had ratified the Epson Act in 2004?
So we lived in a little area in Dublin 8, lovely little neighbourhood. And in the early years, Elsie got preschool with Enable Ireland. And they were, I mean, unbelievable. And so I was very lucky. I was actually very lucky that she didn't walk till she was six, because that's how I got her into Enable Ireland. So I always looked at the things she could do and not what she couldn't do. But to access services, you have to actually find a label to put her on. So she wasn't walking at six. So I went to Enable Ireland. I said, look, she's a physical disability. She's not walking. So I got her into the preschool there. And that was life changing, because she got all the therapeutic interventions that she needed early. And then when it came to school time, there was a lovely little national school at the end of our street, and she got a place there, and it opened up our lives. Because one of the things I find really emotional and difficult is I always wanted to walk Elsie to school. And you see parents, that's the biggest privilege you can have for your child, to walk her to school. And that happened for us for a very short period of time. She went to the mainstream school at the end of the street. We used to walk her to school. I just loved that. But it didn't last long. And we met our neighbours in the area, and they're still lifelong friends. Elsie made friends. But then the support just wasn't there. And I can't blame the school. At the time I did, because I was naive. But, you know, having a support for Elsie just to kind of babysit her in class isn't enough. They needed to bring the occupational therapist, the speech therapist. They needed the teachers to be fully trained, you know, to integrate somebody that has different challenges in the classroom. In a large classroom of like 26 people, they need an individual education plan, which isn't enforceable under the Epson Act because it hasn't been, you know, it hasn't been ratified. They needed, you know, a special statement of educational assessment to show what she needed to be able to be part of a mainstream, which the word mainstream I hate as well, classroom. And none of those were there for her. So she got to, she went in as a frail little 5 or 6 year old in a walker. And by the time she got to third class, she was a big girl, and they just, you know, behavior, her behaviors, her means of communication, that was seen as a negative, because she was overwhelmed and she wasn't properly supported. So then our only option then was either she gets expelled from school, and at like 10, you don't really want your child expelled from school. So we had to look for a special school. And then she's segregated and not included, and I couldn't get to walk her to school.
And I'm having so many moments of insight from what you're saying. And I hate the word mainstream now as well. What on earth does that even mean? Yeah. And when we talk about neurodivergence, which we're talking about a lot more now, when we talk about the current system looks after one way of learning. Mm-hmm. And if we changed it to bring in neurodivergent, those with additional needs, every unique person, it would benefit all.
Yeah.
At the moment, it's only benefiting one way and leaving out other ways. Mm. But if we changed it, it would actually benefit everybody. Mm-hmm. Because for Elsie and other kids like Elsie to be included in a classroom, that benefits everybody. And that means then in the workplace, that's becomes the norm. Mm-hmm. In society, that becomes the norm. In communities, that becomes the norm.
It all starts with education. You know, if you don't start it early, how can you change your society? And how can, you know, you create an environment where, and the little friends Elsie met who are now in their 20s, they are Elsie's friends and she has had them all her life. And they're all different in different ways. Everybody is. And as you say correctly, our education system is just about a small few. And that's why, you know, we've since COVID, I suppose, there's been a lot of issues with young people with anxiety. It's not catering for anybody. And, you know, you cater for the few, but you lose the most of the people that really make up our society and make it different and make us unique and give us different ways of thinking and approaching things and approaching people and value of people where they, you know, you value their differences rather than you segregate their differences.
How has this impacted you and your life?
That's an interesting question. I suppose it's given me, I was one of those lucky few that probably was a mainstream education person. Like, education came easy to me. My exams came easy to me. Most things in life, you know, came easy. So I didn't, in hindsight, have the appreciation that I have for people that things don't come easy to. And had I not had my daughter, I don't think I ever would have that eye-opening moment. So I have immeasurable patience now, which I have to have. But I do get jaded and I get tired. And I always say to people that you can't be everything to everybody. And we have had and always have support at home. And we have carers that come in and Elsie knows that she needs support. So when Elsie has support, then I have time to be me and to be here talking to you and to work. And then, you know, I'm lucky I have a supportive employer. So they give me that flexibility to, you know, to be me and to also care for Elsie. And that's really important. So I see how this has impacted me in only positive ways. I was never one for like, oh, poor me, because it's not poor you. It's it enhances your life and changes your life immeasurably and gives you, you know, different ways of looking for solutions to different problems. And so I think that I wouldn't change one bit of it.
And what a gift, again, that would be for fellow classmates to learn by sharing a room and a life with Elsie, as you have. How is Elsie now, today?
Well, she's a complete character. She, thankfully, to her little brief period in mainstream school, she's unbelievably with literacy. So I get literal text messages, updates of everything. So what time the carer arrives, what time, what she did, what she didn't do. She loves to write stories. So it gives me great comfort because she can communicate with me what's happening. And she wants to know the ins and outs of everything. She's nosy, which is great. She loves life. She describes herself as an adult doll collector. So we spend a lot of time in toy shops and her big wish is to actually get a little part-time job in a toy shop. But again, she'd need support to do that. So we've visited a few local toy shops. She's done an interview in her own head. And when they asked her why she wanted to work in a toy shop, she said it was her lifelong dream. She knows she'd need support to be there. But it's just, you know, getting the opportunity for her. It's really, really, really difficult.
And you were telling me this previously on one of our phone chats, and she'd be a great employee. You said if you were there in the toy shop with her, she'll go over and advise,
oh yeah,
you know, parents of other families and kids about which toy they should get and which would suit them, because she knows this so well.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's helped make sales.
She has. She, the first thing she'll say is, "Mom, Mom, how old is she?" So I have to actually introduce myself to complete strangers and then ask how old their children are. And then they'll say, "Oh, she's six. It's her birthday." And then Elsie will ask, "Are you into Barbies?" And if they're not, then she'll, you know. So we spend quite a bit of time in toy shops meeting people and, you know, selling toys on behalf of the toy shop. And then, of course, buying toys, because she'll say to me, "Oh, Mom, please, can I have that?" And then she'll go, "You'll never retire." So... yeah, that's her. She loves, absolutely loves toys, yeah.
Well, any wish I get, be it blown a dandelion or a candle, I'm going to be wishing for Elsie to get that job, a part-time job in a toy shop and make her dream come true.
Thank you,
Do you still worry for her future?
I do, yeah, I really do. Because I, you know, Elsie will need support for the rest of her life. Because she has abilities, you take her to an environment that's a segregated, disability-focused, you know, residential or whatever. And I've had a couple of experiences and they'll say, "Oh, no, she's not for us. She's complex." And I'm like, "Can you describe what complex means? Is it complex because she has abilities and will be able to advocate for herself and then she won't do what you want her to do and she won't be compliant because she is an adult? Or is she complex that you feel you can't support her?" You don't really get a good answer to that one. So we're at the point now where, you know, I'm getting older. Elsie's, you know, getting older. And we're, you know, worrying about when we're not here. And I think it's a really common problem. There's been groups set up for people in Ireland that are still, you know, parents to young people that are in their 30s and 40s. And there's no provision being made as to what happens when those parents pass. And I'm at that point now. I'm trying to forward plan for Elsie, for her future. So that she can live her full life. And she describes her adulthood as happy, loves life. And I want that to continue. I want her to live as long and full and as happy life as I have. But she needs support to do that.
Well, I'll be adding a list of wishes for Elsie and other people like her. And back to the language, we seem to be more about crowd control than true inclusion. Yeah. And that's the biggest wish. Marina, thank you so much. I knew this would be an important conversation, but it's really blown me away. Marina Giblin, Senior Portfolio Manager and mother to Elsie. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Claire.
So that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Aoife Breen, to Hugo De Silva Scott, who was on sound. Rory Galvin was on podcasts. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.